Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. Historians make notoriously bad predictors of the future. So when, in our last football-themed podcast, Tom Holland and I predicted that England would crash out humiliatingly to the Germans in the second round of Euro 2020, we knew, of course, that we would be proved comprehensively wrong. And so we were. Tom, great scenes. England beating Germany in a major tournament for the first time. Well, for the first time for 20 years, but the first time in the knockouts since 1966.
Great scenes indeed, which I witnessed live, but I think you didn't.
That's right.
As you said in the episode we recorded on Anglo-German relations preceding that match, you said that you had to go to your son's, was it sports day?
No, it was play. It was a play.
Oh, it was a play. Yes.
I basically have a succession of school-themed events. So Sports Day was about 10 days ago, and I missed something else because of Sports Day.
And this was Mermaids against Pirates.
Pirates versus Mermaids. It was the big clash that everybody was talking about. And I'm happy to report that it ended in a score draw with honours even. And I went, obviously, in a very sort of anxious...
Grumpy.
Yeah, in a very anxious way. And... as I was sort of sitting there deliberately, not, you know, just the clock had just ticked past 5 o'clock. So the kickoff had begun, had happened. And I was deliberately not catching anybody's eye, looking at any of the other dads or anything like this, because I was recording the match and determined to get back to watch it. And to my relief, the very admirable music teacher, Mr. Price, gave an announcement. And he said, do not check your phones. Do not communicate anything about the match because some of us are recording it.
What a wise man.
Yeah, it was very impressive. That, to me, is the mark of a great schoolmaster, which he clearly is.
And so you managed to see it not knowing the result.
So I got home. I didn't look out the window of the car. I ran into the house the back way so I wouldn't go past our neighbour's front window where they could see they were still watching the final scenes and I didn't want to see the expression on their faces. And then we watched the whole thing. Yeah, it's brilliant. It was brilliant. I know this is a tragic insight into my tortured psyche.
No, not at all. I can't imagine anything worse than having to miss out on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, pretending to take an interest in your son's play. I'm sure you did take an interest
I did take an interest in the play.
Not to boast or anything.
He's going to boast?
I'm going to boast. I was rather stressed. I needed England to win in full time.
Because?
Because at 7 o'clock, I had to go and interview Francis Fukuyama, author
the End of History.
The End of History. And I'd already put him off an hour. Yeah. That was the best
thing to do. Francis Fukuyama, a big admirer of the Euros.
So we started talking. I was rather intimidated to be talking to this, you know, this great luminary. So I didn't, at the beginning, explain why I'd pushed it back an hour and why I was had a big smirk on my face.
Yeah, St. George's cross painted on your face.
Yes. Yes. So I didn't explain that. And then by the end, things had sufficiently warmed up that I gave the reason. And of course, his whole thesis is that the end of history means that...
England has won.
Well, essentially, you know, the violent passions and rivalries that previously had convulsed European history are now at an end.
Francis, you're quite wrong.
But he's all in favour of international sporting competitions because he thinks that that preserves the end of history because we're channeling our passions and our enthusiasms into abusing each other on terraces rather than kind of bombing Hamburg.
That's so, absolute balderdash, though. I mean, the football war in Central America.
Are you calling Francis Fukuyama what he said, balderdash?
And also the breakup of Yugoslavia was preceded by, you know, the sort of signs of it were on the football field. The future Croat captain, Zvonimir Boban, fighting riot police in about 1990.
Was often used as a
harbinger of the bloodshed to come.
I didn't tell him that.
You should have done. You missed your chance.
He's Francis Fukuyama.
But you're Tom Holland. Have faith in yourself, man.
Who am I to lecture Francis Fukuyama on sport? Anyway, this is all by the by. The reason that we're back here with a special is that England are meeting Ukraine in Rome. And so we did an episode on Anglo-German relations, which obviously was quite a lot to talk about. Anglo-Ukrainian relations, bit more of a challenge, isn't it?
There's more than you'd think. I mean, let's start off by saying Ukraine is an unbelievably interesting country. I mean, Kievan Rus, as it began, and part of the...
Very dramatic.
Attacked by the Mongols. So it's got a Viking stuff, which I'm sure we're going to come back to, sort of Viking involvement. Then it's totally destroyed, isn't it, by the Mongols. Becomes part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which I always think we should do a podcast about because it's just such a strange state. Carved up between the Austrian and Russian empires. I mean, there's so much to talk about with Ukraine, actually. I mean, we haven't quite got mentioned the English element, but we'll come to that.
Okay, well, I'm going to say something provocative, which is that if Ukraine beat England, football will be going home.
A ludicrous view, and I'd like to hear you justify it.
Okay, I will do that. So the word football, compound word, foot and ball.
Thanks for that.
What are the origins of these words? What's the etymological ancestry? Well, English is an Indo-European language. And where is the homeland of the Indo-Europeans?
Is it the steppes of Ukraine?
It is. Yeah, southern Russia and the steppes of Ukraine. So above the Caspian and the Black Sea. I mean, that's the almost overwhelming consensus. Obviously, there are people who think maybe the Indo-Europeans came from Anatolia or from Atlantis or India. But generally, that's the consensus opinion. So that means that the word foot, the original, the kind of, we don't know what the proto-Indo-European word was, but linguists have kind of basically worked out that it was something along the lines of pods or ped. So you get that in Latin, in Greek, Sanskrit, you get PA in French. And the Germanic strand, the P turned to an F, but the best one is ball. And it was in Old English, it was Bial.
Yeah.
In Proto-Germanic, apparently it was Balus. And in Proto-Indo-European, it was Bial, which apparently meant...
Say that last one again.
Bial. That's how they spoke on the steppes in 4000 BC. Yeah.
Okay.
And that meant blow, inflate, swell. So it's a kind of, like a blown-up ball.
Okay, but Tom, this is a claim you could make about almost anything, right? I mean, you could claim dishwashers were Ukrainian because the word for dish comes from the Indo-European
If I was doing a podcast about Anglo-Ukrainian attitudes to dishwashers, that's exactly the argument I would make.
Right.
But since this is prompted by a football match, I'm focusing on football. So football will be going home.
Yeah, well, the word football. I mean, not the practice.
The word. Yes, the word. I agree it's a bit of a stretch, but I thought you'd be more impressed by that than you
should. No, I am impressed. I mean, I'll tell you who would have been impressed by that, the late J.R.R. Tolkien. He was a great man
for the
roots of words. Yeah. He would have loved that. So you've ticked that box, if he's listening, which he isn't. well, if he were listening, he'd really enjoy it. Anyway,
this is classy podcasting.
I'm confident you have something more substantive to offer about... Surely there must have been Anglo-Saxons involved in the Ukraine.
Almost certainly. Yes, there were. So we talked about the Viking origins of Kiev.
Yeah.
And the Rus, which mean rowers, were basically Swedes who came down the great rivers.
The Great.
Yes. And they established Kiev as a kind of stronghold controlling the trade routes. And it became a kind of a piratical empire.
Yeah.
And Vladimir of Kiev converts to Christianity, the Christianity that you get in Constantinople, because he didn't want to become Muslim because he couldn't drink. He thought that the cathedrals of the Latin Christians were not as impressive as Hagia Sophia.
Don't they go down and they see the Hagia Sophia and they're absolutely astounded?
Yeah, they say, I had not thought that anything so beautiful could be seen. He thinks it's a vision of heaven. And so that persuades him to sign up to the Byzantine form of Christianity. And so the Kievan Rus are absorbed into the world of Byzantium. And they have a slightly kind of ambivalent status because the Vikings are perpetually coming down and attacking Constantinople. But as they get converted to Christianity, so they become kind of allies of the Byzantine emperors. And they start to recruit Vikings as personal guards for the emperor on the assumption that they are kind of neutral, that they can be relied upon. Then this is the famous Varangian Guard. After 1066, large numbers of displaced Anglo-Saxon aristocrats, nobility, seem to have migrated to Constantinople and to have joined the Varangian Guard. And there are various reports, various kind of sagas, so on, saying that they arrive when Constantinople is under siege, presumably by the Turks. They play a heroic role in this, and as a reward, the emperor says, "You know, what can we give you?" And some of them say, "We would like to form a new England." And there's a wonderful paper by the historian Caitlin Green, who writes fabulous stuff about all kinds of intriguing early medieval, you know, Byzantine coins that pop up in Japan and so on. She's written this fantastic piece about saying, was there truth to this? Did the Byzantine emperor grant a new England to the Anglo-Saxon Varangians? And she argues that it was granted to them on Crimea.
Okay.
And she said, you know, there are various kind of chronicles, sagas throughout the Middle Ages that make reference to this. In the Edward saga, which is 14th century Icelandic saga, but drawing on apparently on 12th century material, to the towns that were in the land and to those which they built, they gave the names of the towns in England. They called them both London and York and by the names of other great towns in England.
So there was a New York in Crimea.
There was a New York, a New England in Crimea, apparently. And as evidence for this, Caitlin cites various Italian charts from the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, which mention a Londina, which is presumably London.
Yeah.
And a place called Sasako, which is Saxon. So Saxon town.
Nice.
Which, you know, so the evidence there
That's amazing.
You know, it's tantalizing.
Yeah.
But I think certainly strong enough for a podcast on Anglo-Ukrainian.
If Vladimir Putin is listening to this, he will be raging. I mean, he will have cancelled his subscription because he would say Ukraine and Crimea are not the same. If Ukrainian listeners are listening, they will be
be
ordering your books in triumph and saying.
But we're looking at this from the medieval perspective, Dominic. And Vladimir is baptized. Vladimir, the first Ukrainian to be Christian, is baptized in Crimea.
Right, I did not know. That's interesting.
So, well, that's
so why Crimea is part of the Ukrainian world, then, without any question.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But that's also why it's so significant for Vladimir Putin and Russia is that it's seen as the birthplace of Russian Christianity as well.
Right.
So when the Russians annexed Crimea, there were kinds of extraordinary photos of priests with their long beards casting holy water onto jets and blessing the Russian forces as they were moving into annex Crimea. So Crimea is a kind of holy place. So it's the Canterbury.
Yeah, like Kosovo for the Serbs. So it's this sort of, you know, place that's become slightly detached from the, you know, it's not part of the main sort of territory, but
Kosovo is a battle, right? I mean, it's
yeah, Kosovo is a battle, but it has a sacred significance.
But I think for both Ukrainians and Russians, the fact that it's baptismal, that it's the wellspring of the Christianity of both the Ukrainians and the Russians, gives it a peculiar resonance because it gives it, you know, it's like Canterbury or Rome or even Jerusalem. It has that kind of holiness to it. When Potemkin captures Crimea for Catherine the Great.
From the Ottomans, isn't it? Yeah.
He says to her, you know, we have captured the birthplace of Russian Christianity, and this is what joins us to Constantinople. And he name references Pompey the Great, he name references Alexander. He says this joins us to the classical traditions and the Christian traditions of our, you know, our Russia as the Third Rome. So it's sacred, you know, it has this kind of holiness both to the Ukrainians and to the Russians.
But of course, to most English speaking, or certainly most British listeners, Crimea has a significance. The Crimean War. It's what people don't really think about the Crimean War now, but there was a time when the Crimean War loomed so large, thanks to Tennyson and his poem, the Charge of the Light Brigade, the Valley of Death, and all that sort of stuff. The first modern war, some people might say, the Crimean War. Do you think?
Yeah, so the Crimean War is fought by a Turkish-Anglo-French alliance.
Such a strange war.
Yes, against the Russians, and it's kind of centered around Sevastopol, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 1853 to 1856. The trigger for the war is who administers the holy places in Ottoman-occupied Israel and Palestine.
So that's another example of how this stuff really matters.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Who owns the holy places?
Yes, it's also about French and Russian sort of national virility. They both, you know, the Russians are expanding. The Ottoman Empire is sort of breaking up. The French want to, and the British want to preserve the Ottoman Empire. They want to stop the Russians getting the Straits, the Constantinople and the gateway to the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. And this sort of blows up into this incredibly vicious war, but also the war with railways, with telegraphs, with photography, with Florence Nightingale.
War correspondence, isn't it? The Times sends a correspondent, and it's the first one where you get reports from the front. And it's the first kind of major European war that Britain has fought, and indeed the French, since the Napoleonic Wars. And there are various kind of generals, aren't there, British generals who keep getting muddled up. And
yeah, let's attack
the French.
It's complete
rather than the Russians.
It's a bit of a shambles, isn't it, the Crimean War? So most famously, and actually we've talked about him a few times, so it seems mad not to mention Flashman. The great Crimean War book, I think, is Flashman at the Charge, in which Flashman is in the thick of all the action.
So
and all these characters, Lord Cardigan and all these people who absolutely despise Flashman, are charging towards Russian guns and being massacred and so on.
So from the footballing point of view, there are two key engagements, two key approaches to attacking your enemy that the Crimean War exemplifies. So you have the Charge of the Light Brigade, which is full on, you know, let's open with Grealish, attack.
That's Kevin Keegan's England, circa 2000.
Which goes disastrously wrong.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Thin Red Line. And Scottish listeners, I hope, will forgive me. The Thin Red Line is actually, it's a Scottish regiment. It's the Sutherland Highlanders. But from the point of view of this podcast, let's say British, English, whatever. And that's where a Russian cavalry force is approaching. They are kind of stranded. It's Colin Campbell who commands them, lines them up, not in four, because they don't have enough to do that. That's the standard approach. He lines them up in, so they're too deep. And this is the Thin Red Line. Vocative phrase. And so that implies defense holding out. So I guess Gareth Southgate is a kind of Thin Red Line man.
He is. He's
rather than there are your guns, my lord. Attack.
Yeah, exactly.
So the Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah.
Just talk us through that, because it's such a great story.
So the Charge of the Light Brigade is an utter shambles. Now, I haven't come prepared for this, Tom, so I'm just trying to remember it. The Russians' guns are at the top of a valley, aren't they?
And at the bottom of a valley, I think.
At the bottom of the valley. Well, they're once end of the valley anyway. Yeah, they're at some end of the valley. So this is a balaclava. Hence, you know, the nice helmet, woolen mask. So I remember the Russians are withdrawing, and the commander says, you know, go and basically get the guns before they withdraw. But somehow in the course of this being relayed to the Light Brigade, they end up pointing at the wrong guns. That's right, isn't it? He says, they're real guns.
So the chain of command, there are three lords, all of whom are useless.
Yeah.
So there's Lord Raglan.
That's right.
Who fought in the Napoleonic Wars. And he's the one who keeps saying, go and attack the French. Despite the fact that the French are his allies. Yeah. And he's about kind of 90 and incredibly doddery.
Yeah.
Then there's Lord Lucan. Ancestor of the Lord Lucan, who will
he doesn't disappear,
and he, I think, is the brother-in-law of Lord Cardigan.
Now, Lord Cardigan who commands
the Light Brigade, but they detest each other.
Yes,
and then there's a guy called Nolan.
He's the intermediary, isn't he? He carries the message. Yeah,
and because none of them are speaking to each other, it doesn't provide for great communication. And so basically there's a snarl up Cardigan says, which guns do you mean? Nolan gestures, and then I think gets shot, gets killed, kind of.
He speaks first, doesn't he? Doesn't he say, there are your guns, my lord, or something?
Yes.
Go and
yes.
get them or whatever. Pointing vaguely into the distance.
And the one rule of war is that if you have cavalry, and particularly light cavalry, you don't use it to charge artillery head
Madness.
On.
Yeah.
So Cardigan thinks this is mad. But because he's been given the order, and because he is, he's just insanely arrogant and stiff-necked.
He's just a Victorian British general, right?
He just does what he does. Yeah. Inventor of the cardigan, of course.
Is he the inventor of the cardigan?
I think that's why, you know, he wears it over his shoulder, doesn't he? Like the kind of jacket.
I didn't know that.
I think so.
That's a great fact.
And so they charge down. They get absolutely devastated. And then the survivors kind of trot back.
But you know what? There's now a revisionist history of this. As with all disastrous British battles, a bit like, you know, the Somme or Passchendaele or whatever, there are military historians now who say, well, actually, you know...
It's quite good, was it?
Yeah, we got the results we wanted or whatever. I mean, I don't...
Yeah, that's very Football Manager.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, all right, we lost 7-0, but...
But, you know...
We've learned lessons.
We go again on Tuesday.
Provides a platform.
Yeah. There's a lot to build on. The last game.
But I mean, it's also very... I mean, I guess this is something that football sport perhaps has inherited. We love a kind of a bloody disaster.
Of course we do. Yeah. And then there's a book, isn't there? Heroic Failure in the British.
So get the Gaza bursting into tears.
Exactly.
As we get knocked out.
Yeah. I mean,
it lives on in the...
It feels slightly un-English to be making sort of unruffled progress through a tournament as we have been doing for the last few games.
And so in a sense, Tennyson's poem on the Charge of the Light Brigade kind of absolutely establishes the template for that. I mean, there is a kind of football chant quality to it.
Well, I think post-colonial historians are sort of not people I normally quote with enormous, overwhelming admiration, but they would say... a lot of this stuff is motivated by guilt, they think, or sort of bad conscience. That the sort of British create this cult of martyrdom, you know, and, oh, we're so outnumbered, we're the underdogs, and we performed heroically and were beaten, to sort of, you know, to sort of cope with the fact that actually they're just mowing people down with Gatling guns.
Except on this occasion, it's because we're grotesquely incompetent.
Yeah. And I think actually this is the other thing. So there's a lot of fan misbehaviour. There's a lot of discontent with the management, which is very football, and there's fan misbehaviour. So in England, the war is quite unpopular with, I think, particularly with the Tories and with Tory voters, and there's all these scenes where people are pelting. There are snowball riots where the fans, as it were, are pelting. I think they were pelting like recruiting officers or something with snowballs. And the government fought, well, the Earl of Aberdeen, who was the Prime Minister, falls, and then Palmerston takes over. Of course, Palmerston is a great man for attacking foreigners.
Sending gunboats.
There are legacies of the Crimean War in lots of towns still. And when we finally, at the end of the war, we captured Sevastopol, there's loads of old Russian guns, cannons, and they were all brought home and they were sent all around the country. I mean, there were some they were sent to like Hartlepool. Every town wanted one, particularly towns that had strongly supported the war. So there's one in Abingdon and there's loads in Canada, actually. There's about 20 still in Canada, these Sevastopol guns. Which was sort of, you know, hurrah, hurrah, we've captured these old Russian cannons. And then some of them were melted down in the Second World War to, you know, build Spitfires or something. So there were sort of weird, you know, relics of the Crimean War in sort of market towns all over England.
Oh, we're just getting a message from our producer. Victoria Cross medals are still made out of melted down Sevastopol guns.
That is controversial. I believe. I think the people have analysed Victoria Cross medals and said, are they
honestly
really
dominate? Just stop ruining. Stop ruining our facts.
Yeah. Stop it with your historical truths.
Well, I mean, and also, of course, the other legacy is nursing.
Florence Nightingale and Mary
Seacole.
Yes.
Who, in a way, has become a kind of icon to the extent that she's replaced Florence Nightingale. Even though she wasn't a nurse. I think she basically just ran a hotel.
Every school child in Britain now learns about Mary Seacole, don't they? I mean, isn't that the sort of... But usually this is prefaced with the words, she's written out of history and nobody reads about her now.
Well, I think it's kind of... It's an interesting example of the way in which we continue to mythologize people from British imperial history, even in the 21st century. Yes. Mary Seacole is an entirely mythologized person in exactly the way that I guess the Earl of Cardington was.
Cardington?
Yeah, Cardigan. Yeah.
Tom, you know, I thought this podcast would take about 10 minutes on Anglo-Ukrainian relations, and partly because we haven't really talked massively about Anglo-Ukrainian relations. We've now got to the end of the first half. Well, there are going to be, it is going to be a game of two halves.
Shall I end it by reading a chunk of Tennyson?
I think that would be absolutely brilliant.
So we'll go out on Tennyson, and you can imagine, let's hope that this doesn't prefigure what happens in Rome. Forward the Light Brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to a Rest is History special on Anglo-Ukrainian relations. As Dominic said before the break, I thought we might struggle to fill out 20 minutes on this. But I've said everything that I know. I now have nothing more to add. But
Dominic is very
confidently saying he's got stuff for another 20 minutes worth.
I never, ever thought I would hear you say those words, Tom. Are you all right? You've said everything you know. I don't know anything else
about Anglo-Ukrainian relations.
You don't know about Huzovka?
No.
Huzovka is such a great story. Okay, so...
Did he have anything to do with the Donbass?
Yes, and he's also not a person, he's a place.
Okay, well, that shows how much I know.
Okay.
So the Donbass, I did a school geography project on it.
Wow. On Donetsk and the sort of coal and iron... one of the most industrial areas of Europe. And now, of course, at the center of this...
So that was in the 70s.
This war, the Russian-Ukrainian kind of undeclared war that's going on in Donetsk and Luhansk.
So I did geography projects on Chicago and on the Donbass. I've never been to either, but I feel I know them.
Do you know what I did? It was my geography project. I did one on open-cast mining.
Of course you did.
So depressing. I mean, I should have done... Why didn't I get to do Chicago? It's so unjust.
I can still draw the map of the airport going out into the lake. Anyway, sorry, we're...
So I keep waiting for the podcast on opencast mining, but I don't think it's going
it to
happen. All right, so mining brings us to the Donbass. So people remember they had the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine at the beginning of the 2010s, and the Russians annexed Crimea, and then there was this fighting in the east. And during all this fighting, a thing went up on the internet, and it said it's time for Donetsk, the city at the center of this, to be the solution is for it to be reunited with the United Kingdom. You know, it should be neither Russian nor Ukrainian, but British. And you might think that's ridiculous, but Donetsk did begin as a British foundation. So late 1860s, the Russian Empire is very rapidly developing, and they need to bring in talent to basically industrialize it. And they do a deal with a company called the Millwall Ironworks and Shipbuilding Company. So you could hardly find a more English company. And the Millwall Ironworks send over a man called John Hughes, who unfortunately for this podcast is Welsh. but he's come from Millwall, Tom. He's come from a Millwall company. So I'm sure
our Welsh listeners
will love this.
Wales into England.
I'm not bundling Wales into podcast. England. I'm elevating Wales above England. I think that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
So John Hughes goes over. He's from Merthyr Tydfil. He goes down to what's now Ukraine, and he picks his spot, and he says, this is the place, iron and coal and stuff. And he starts bringing over, the Russians don't have the skilled engineers and stuff, so he brings over hundreds of largely Welsh skilled labourers and engineers and miners and so on to set up his factories. And they do, and by the end of the century, there's about 30,000 people living there, a lot of them Welsh or English. There's an Anglican church, there are there's an English-speaking school. So, and this is what's going to become Donetsk. And at the time, it's called Hughesovka. So it's named after John Hughes. And it's basically a sort of British and mixed British, Ukrainian and Russian community in Ukraine. And it's one of the sort of big industrial, becoming one of the, already one of the big industrial powerhouses of Central and Eastern Europe. And basically, it continues as that until the Russian Revolution, when all the Brits are kicked out. So, and it's extraordinary that some of them have gone from rags to riches to rags again. So they've come from, you know, nothing in South Wales. They've worked their way up. They go to, they've gone out to the Russian Empire, and they've made a lot of money, and they live in, you know, with servants and things. And then the Russians kick them out, and they come back to Wales with nothing. So that's an extraordinary story. And of course, it doesn't stay as Hughesovka. It is renamed Stalino. Ends up becoming Donetsk.
Is there any move to rename it? Give it back its original name?
I don't think so. I think basically the
Constantinople,
Russians, the Russians. Yeah, the Russians and the Ukrainians are fighting very sort of fiercely over it.
So making it British again, making it British again would be a kind of answer, wouldn't it?
Would. You could give it an MP, could be a county, I suppose.
Great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, the Donbass.
And they've probably got some great footballers, and then they could play for England.
Yeah, I mean, Shakhtar Donetsk was often in the Champions League. They imported a lot of Brazilian players. I don't think they relied on local talent particularly. They had a very fetching kind of orangey strip. I think they'd do very well in the Premier League. I'd like to see them in the Premier League. Well, but there's also another sort of quite weird Welsh connection. So Ukraine has this absolutely ghastly 20th century history. I mean, I read something the other day when I was thinking about this, that some American scholar who's basically said there is no example anywhere in the world of a country that has sort of suffered more chaotic and miserable time than Ukraine after the First World War. So after the First World War, I think there were 7 different armies fighting for control of Ukraine. So there's White Russians, there's the Bolsheviks, there's some anarchists, there's the Poles. There's, I think, 2 different groups of Ukrainian nationalists. So it's just an absolute nightmare. And that game continues because Ukraine has the famine in the early 1930s. And then obviously...
So that's under Stalin.
Yeah, under Stalin. Then the Nazis attack. Some of them help the Nazis. Some of them fight against the Nazis. The Red Army counterattacks. Then there's a kind of more stuff with the Poles going on. It's just an utter, utter, utter nightmare. And the historian Timothy Snyder has this book, Bloodlands. And Ukraine is absolutely the center of this sort of literally blood-soaked territory where people are being thrown into mass graves and all this stuff. But amid all this, one of the massive events in Ukrainian identity is the Holodomor, the famine of the early 1930s. And it's a British journalist who exposes this, a man called Gareth Jones, another Welshman.
There's a film about him, wasn't there?
I think by common consent, of quite a poor film, actually. James Norton played him. He's from Barry in South Wales. He works for The Times. He goes to Russia and to Ukraine. Here's an amazing connection. His mother had worked in Huzovka as the tutor of John Hughes's son.
Only connect.
Isn't that bizarre?
That is bizarre.
And then he doesn't have a massive interest in Russia. He studies French, Gareth Jones, I think at Cambridge, and then goes to work for The Times and ends up being sent back to this place where his mother had worked as a tutor.
But purely coincidentally.
And he discovers that the famine is happening, and he writes reports about it in The Times. And then probably one of the most famous journalistic scandals of the 20th century. A man called Walter Duranty, who worked for the New York Times, who was also British-born, but had become American. Duranty is kind of in with Stalin. He writes these appalling, appalling stories in the New York Times saying that Gareth Jones is lying and that there is no famine. And actually, Duranty knew that Jones was telling the truth. But through journalistic competition and through wanting to keep in with Stalin, he just lied about it.
The New York Times, eh?
Well, you know my opinion of the New York Times, Tom, is, I mean, there are very few newspapers I hold in lower regard than the New York Times. So there's part of me that is very satisfied by telling this story. Poor old Jones comes to a very sticky end. He goes off to Mongolia after being in Ukraine. He's banned from Russia, from the Soviet Union. He goes off to Mongolia and he's murdered, I think probably by the NKVD, by Stalin's secret police. So it's a very unfortunate ending. But, you know, if things get a bit testy on the pitch on Saturday night, the England players should remind the Ukrainians that Britain has a history of looking out for Ukraine and sticking up for it when others were lying.
And the Crimea. The Crimea is New England.
Yeah. I mean, that would go down very badly because the Crimea will be a sore spot for the Ukrainian players, I imagine. So
I think keep off the topic of history. Probably safest.
Do you think,
actually, as a rule of thumb?
Yeah. Harry Maguire is meant to be a great history buff because when he was arrested. So Harry Maguire, for those people who don't know, is the sort of enormously
huge-headed
England centre back. Very good, very underrated player in my view. Anyway, Harry Maguire was arrested in Greece. Greece, of course, has its own connections with Ukraine because there were Greek settlements, weren't there? In Crimea and so on. So Harry Maguire was arrested in Greece, and apparently the Greek police claimed he'd been misbehaving or he'd been involved. Well, I'm probably introducing him there. I don't think he had been misbehaving. I think there'd been some fracas in a nightclub or similar, and there'd then been a fracas with the police. And the police claimed that Harry Maguire had shouted, I won't say exactly, he shouted, F the Greek police, F Greek civilization. When I heard that, I thought, I don't genuinely believe that the captain of Manchester United shouted about Greek civilization at 3 o'clock in the morning as he was being bundled into the back of a police van. You know, does Harry Maguire have strong views about Aristotle?
Athenian imperialism.
Yeah, exactly. I've always been a Persian man. Xerxes was framed.
Damn you for invading Sicily.
Yeah.
Never forget. Well,
so, I mean, I think it's unlikely that he will.
Did you see this huge skull that got discovered?
Of Harry Maguire or of some other person?
Adam Rutherford wittily said that Harry Maguire looked like this incredible skull that was found in China.
There's something that always I find very satisfying about watching English sporting teams is when they look like people from the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry, or Second World War from newsreels and stuff. And Harry Maguire absolutely has that slightly frowning, slightly pained, anxious expression.
Yeah, about to go over the top.
Or somebody going abroad. I always think of English people when they were filmed going abroad. Sort of people like the miners from Derbyshire in the 1950s who famously went on a lot to Italy on a coach tour with, they packed the inside of the coach with tins of baked beans because they were suspicious of the Italian food. I think Harry Maguire is absolutely a man of that ilk.
Whereas Jack Grealish, I think, looks like someone out of Dickens.
I can definitely see Jack Grealish in the First World War.
The Joker of the trench,
all that sort of.
He's the Artful Dodger.
You know, doing his hair, brill creamed hair in the trench, going off to the
cheery.
Yeah. Very popular with the local girls in the bombed out French town that they pass through.
And Harry Kane looks like a Habsburg prince.
Yes, he does. Yes, he absolutely does. That's a very good call. So he could have.
So I'd say Harry Maguire is First World War. Yeah. Jack Grealish is Victorian. Harry Kane is 16th century.
Well, I see Harry Kane is the kind of man who could have ruled Western Ukraine, Galicia. He could have visited Lviv on sort of imperial archducal visits or something, don't you think?
Yeah, I think we're spiraling off here. I think we'll be losing our listeners. So, Dominic, if suppose England win.
Yes. Let's.
And I think we should say we think they're going to lose. Because it worked last time, didn't it?
Yeah, it did work.
So we think we're going to lose.
I think it'll be very frustrating and we'll lose 1-0. Very disappointing.
But if we win, then there'd be opportunities for a further one, particularly if it's Denmark, England, Anglo-Danish relations.
Anglo-rich. Yeah, that's a great team. I mean, that's basically a podcast series rather than a podcast. Anglo-Czech relations.
Well, there's one obvious.
Will be another stretch. Yes. I think.
No. We've got. Well, I mean, apart from Chamberlain, there's John Dee going to Prague.
Okay, so
there's great stuff.
Yeah, great scenes. We just need to see what would be a problem for us is I think a Czech-Ukrainian semi-final because I think Czech-Ukrainian relations would be beyond even your mighty talents, Tom.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Let's hope England win. But as I say, we think they're going to lose.
May the best. Well, good luck to the Ukrainians. I hope they play well. I hope they.
To be honest, I think the Ukrainian victory would bring Ukrainians greater joy than us, and
it would.
Think that they need it more.
They've had a dreadful.
They've had a bad ten years.
They've had a bad century.
So if England lose, I will bear that in mind.
Yeah, that's a very nice note.
That thought
on which to end.
Okay, thanks very much for listening. Bye bye.
Okay, bye bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.